Hi everyone, I'm Liam and welcome to another episode of Exploring the NQS, a bonus series from the Early Education Show exclusively for our Patreon supporters. So, if you're listening to this, that means you're supporting the main show, which means I want to start with a big thank you. The main show will always be free, but those of you who choose to actually support us financially really, really help us out. In Exploring the NQS, I take a look at one element of the National Quality Standard, one at a time, until I've covered all 40. My background is as an early childhood educator and teacher, centre director, and I currently oversee professional learning and development for Northside Community Service, a not-for-profit early education provider based in Canberra. All right, let's get started. This week, we're up to element 3.2.1, inclusive environment. It's part of Quality Area 3, physical environment, and it's the first element of Standard 3.2, use. The description for this element is, outdoor and indoor spaces are organised and adapted to support each child's participation and to engage every child in quality experiences in both built and natural environments. Alright, so what's this one all about? Now this standard is a bit easier to get into the detail of. Standard 3.1 design is a little drier and not my area particularly as well. Use is something I'm far more comfortable talking about. So this element, inclusive environment, this is really about saying how do we make sure that every child in the service is able to get the best learning and well-being outcomes because of the spaces in the service. So obviously this is still kind of separate from educator interactions and engagement. We've talked a bit about that in Quality Area 1, Educational Program and practice, and we'll be talking about that a lot in Quality Area 5 relationships with children. So this is about saying, this entire element, you can kind of, is really about, how do we do this before children set foot in the door? So all the planning we do, the setup, the spaces, how they look, how can we ensure we've done everything we can to ensure that children can actively engage in this space and that we're not, making it hard for particular groups of children or particular individuals, and that really children are able to get the best out of this space and they're able to get the benefits of the educational program and the practice we're planning and the relationships that we're engaging with. All right, so what does this element look like in practice? The first thing I want to think about here is that when we see things, terms like inclusive environment, and we focus on that term inclusion, I think we kind of automatically then leap to things like disabilities or a diagnosis of a particular condition. How can we help children, with a particular diagnosis engage in a service? And while that's part of this element, it's not just about that. So it's not just about, disabilities or medical conditions, in inverted commas. This is about saying, how can we ensure that every child can participate? And what's always been important to me in terms of working with children, and actually it's the same with adults as well, is that at given points of time everyone will have a particular special requirement to engage in the service. It might be just due to a particular point in time when you're going through a particular challenge or particular stress that you need particular support. It isn't just about a permanent or non-permanent disability or medical condition. So what they're saying is about it, we're adapting the environment we have. So if we look back to Standard 3.1 was design, which is kind of really just about the bones of the building. This is kind of what you have. The use is kind of about, what do we do with that space? So the space is what it is, how are we then using it? So we're saying we want to make sure that we're adapting that space, that framework, those bones, that we're adapting them from the lens of participation for all children. And so what that comes down to for me is not about knowing, disability or what medical condition or what particular needs a child has, but about knowing children holistically. The Early Years Learning Framework talks about this a lot, where we say that holistic approaches to children are critical because it's about knowing the whole child as best we can. So about knowing the children we're working with and what the particular needs of particular children are and a particular group of children. But it's also about then the local community as well. We might want to be thinking there about things like AEDC data, the Australian Early Development Census, where we can see maybe what the particular at a broad community level what the issues facing particular children are. So you might want to focus on things like language or cognitive development or social, emotional development, all those different kind of things. But what it really comes down to is about knowing the children we're with. And that's important because children change and the children as individuals, so a child, I even think particularly of toddlers, which is why for me, toddler rooms are so challenging. If you look at a child as they've turned 24 months and then, the 12-month progress to 36 months is just incredible. It's just huge. And it's the same for all children. So the children will change, which means your environment and your use of that environment has to change as well. But it's also about, you know, that your cohort of children is changing as well. If you're working in early education, like me, at least every 5 years, you have an entirely new community of children come through, which means, you know, your environment shouldn't be looking the same. It should be making sure, well, you know, what do we need to change? What do we need to tweak? Or what do we need to radically change to make sure we're meeting the needs of the current cohort of children we're with? That's really important. The other thing here is also thinking about how are we including this in the programs and the documentation. What's the documentation we're including? I'm going to talk a bit about this later on as well. But, you know, really thinking about the links to Quality Area 1. What is the planning? How are we engaging with the planning cycle around our environment? How are we seeing, you know, potentially what a particular issue is that maybe is stopping someone participating? How are we engaging that? What questions are we asking? What are we trialing? What are we reviewing? And then what are we implementing? It is really important to link this directly with Quality Area 1. The other point I'd be looking at here in terms of practice is really focusing on indoor and outdoor. And the guide to the NQF is really quite clear on this and goes into some detail. So I really recommend reading it for this particular point. But it's about acknowledging that, you know, the use of the environment isn't just around, you know, the separation between indoor and outdoor. And I think the sector has become really good at this in the last few years. We've started to see those lines blur, which is great. But I know, and I would have been guilty of this as anyone, is that you sort of planned all your learning experiences and your learning spaces and your home corner and your dressing up area and all those different, you know, segregated areas. You sort of planned those indoor. You know, that's where you had to plan the spaces. And the outdoor was kind of free play. And you kind of just let them run wild. We now know that's not the case, and that we can have, you know, the things we used to think about the outdoor environments, you know, can be brought inside, and the inside can be brought outside as well. So we do want to think, in particular if we're thinking about inclusion, and we're thinking about, well, how can everyone engage in the space? The outdoor environment is really critically important to think about for a couple of reasons. One, we know that, you know, at a really high level, this is incredibly generalizing, but we know from the research, as is true, is that children are getting less time in the outdoors, they're getting less time engaging in risky play, they're getting less time engaging in challenging play where they're forced to problem solve and do all those kind of things. So making sure that when we think about an inclusive environment, how are we making sure we're supporting children who may be coming to us from a variety of different backgrounds where they may be incredibly unused to doing those kind of things or maybe incredibly strong in it. So getting that balance right between supporting risky play for children who need to engage with it, as well as challenging children who maybe are more competent, is a really big challenge. But we need to think about how we can do that. The other thing to think about here now is we know that there's been a large number of new services being built that don't have great outdoor spaces. They're getting waivers for physical environments, for one of these particular elements and regulations, where, you know, they're being built potentially in high-story, you know, high-rise buildings. They've got maybe just this astroturfed outdoor space. So really thinking about that's a huge challenge, and how can we make sure that that's actually inclusive for everyone, and that we're not just sort of looking at inclusion through the lens of lowest common denominator, that we're sort of soft-falling everything and making sure nothing is challenging or nothing is risky. You know, that's not inclusion. That's wrapping everything in bubble wrap, and then, you know, no one could enjoy it. So, balancing that indoor-outdoor is really important. And then the third thing I think about in terms of, you know, in practice is really looking at spaces through the lens of relationships. And, you know, I think about spaces for relationships. You know, that's what they are at the end of the day. You know, the actual physical, you know, structure of the building is less important than how they're used. And obviously that's why this standard 3.2 use is so important. But really thinking about how are the spaces for relationship. And what we want to be thinking about particularly here is how are we engaging with a particular space to support, really small groups of children to engage in particular things, either one-on-one so they can work alongside a peer, or, in smaller groups, 3, 4, 5 children. The setup of these spaces is really critically important. There's no magic formula for it, and it would be hard to get across in an audio podcast anyway. But, you know, what the Guide to the National Quality Framework and what a lot of the research tells us, and, you know, I might put a shout out here to Designs for Living and Learning by Deb Curtis and Margie Carter, who had a big impact on me as I went through my studies. What they sort of talk about is that, you know, really linking really carefully about the space you have and having clearly defined areas where children can engage in uninterrupted play. And so what we're talking about there is not interruption necessarily by adults, which we'll be getting into in relationships with children in Quality Area 5, but, you know, that idea that children have to walk through a particular space to get somewhere else. So, you know, if they want to go to the home corner, they've got to walk through the block area at a really basic level. So you want to try and avoid that that as much as possible and have thoroughfares where children can access and engage. That's at a really, really basic level, and probably, you know, Kerner and Cardis will not thank me for mangling their amazing thoughts about what they do. But you can get a lot of advice and a lot of support for how that's done. Like I said, there is no formula. You need to really think about the space you have. What are the spaces that are important for you in your thinking about your children, your community? You know, it's not, there's no sort of magic formula that says you have to have X, Y, Z. The only thing I really would suggest, if I could make this a rule and a law, I would, is spaces for books and stories, and having a dedicated space that is really obvious and children want to go to, where children can engage with literature, with reading, and where there are educators available to be reading stories to children. That would be the first thing I would put into any learning environment. That would be the first thing I would think about, honestly. And not just because, you know, that's something I valued and still value as a reader, it's because we know it's pretty much one of the only guaranteed best strategies to support children's learning and their well-being. It's part of relationship building as well. So really thinking about how can we set up a space through the lens of relationships is really important. And adding that as we're planning our particular things, how is that helping children build relationships with each other and with educators and with adults? And the space itself, the relationship children have with their environment, is important as well. Thinking about it through that lens will really help us make good decisions for how we set up our environment. All right, so let's move on now to suggestions for nominated supervisors. Just a couple of quick things here. One thing I would do is make the room environment set up. So if you have your team leaders who are, you're probably delegating that responsibility to set up the environment with your support or with the support of the educational leader, is really make that a part of quality area one. Make that part of the expectations you have for quality area one. And what I sort of mean by that is that we're really documenting the meetings and the plans and the reviews of environments to ensure that they're working. So what that kind of does is make sure that we're not just sort of setting up environments, because that's the way we've always done it. So, you know, we're walking into a space and we're kind of just leaving it as it always was. And, you know, we have these particular areas because, well, that's what, you know, every centre I've worked at has. But B is also ensuring that we're really following that planning cycle for environments as well, that where we are questioning, we are analysing, we are reviewing, and we're trialling and implementing and seeing what's happened. And that's also important, you know, for assessment and rating, that you can demonstrate you've gone through that process for your environments is a really great way of meeting or exceeding the requirements of this element as well as quality area one. And that means we can, you know, as the nominated supervisor, you can be really sure that some thought has gone into why that's happening. And it gives you a way to engage with that process as well. I think it's harder to come in and sort of go into a space that, you know, a team leader, you know, rightly or wrongly has set up the way they want it, but maybe without going through a process with their team or with you or documenting that process. I think it's often challenging to come in and go, well, I don't like it. But if you can make sure there's a process before then, you can engage in that process in a positive way that sets people up to succeed. That means that people don't feel bad about the work they've done. The other one, and this bit of advice probably isn't necessarily embedded anywhere in the NQF, but this is maybe a bit of a bugbear of mine is, you know, I summarize it as don't fall for fads. I think one of the things we're incredibly guilty of in the sector is that a big fad comes along or a big approach, and I won't name any particular ones here because I'll probably offend half the audience, but, you know, there might be an approach that works overseas or, you know, might be one that's quite popular in the sector for a particular period of time. It's often dominated by lots of photos on Facebook, so beautifully set up environments, usually with no children in, I should say. Beautifully set up environments that, you know, everything's from a particular store and everything has a particular wood grain and all those kind of things. It's not to say that those things can't be good, but, you know, don't fall for fads just because they look good. What the NQF is crystal clear about, it probably will be the overall theme of this entire series when I do my big wrap-up episode of the entire standard, will be the entire point of the NQF is about your individual service in your individual community working with your individual groups of children. So our starting point shouldn't be what works for that service over there or what works for that service in this other country. It should be what works for the children you're working with, and what isn't working, what do you need to change and face. So always start with the children and the families and the communities and the educators that are with you right now. Get advice and inspiration potentially from other people, but don't necessarily just follow something because it's a trend or a fad in the sector. Really think about, well, what do we know works? What doesn't work? I know I've seen a lot of particularly new services start up, and they, you know, they've kind of almost copied and pasted a particular look from another service, and they really struggle with getting those environments to work with children because, well, for a whole variety of reasons, but, you know, often the fads aren't about a particular learning approach to children. They're kind of about selling a space to families because at the end of the day, the families are paying the bill. But we really want to think about what's going to work for children. So this is kind of my slight rant about that is don't fall for the fads. Trust your instincts, trust your qualifications and engagement as a professional and institute what works, what you think will work for the children that you're working with. And if it doesn't work, that's great. That's a process to go through and go, okay, what do we need to tweak? What do we need to do differently? What isn't working for this particular child or this particular group of children? How can we make sure that every child is engaged with this space? And then with the quality improvement plan, look, a couple of pretty straightforward ones here. Actually, I'm probably only going to do one here because I think it is relatively straightforward. I would go each classroom and the outdoor area or areas are regularly assessed to ensure that all children can experience positive learning and well-being. I think I've deliberately kind of left that a little bit vague in terms of how you want to assess that. I don't think a checklist is necessarily the way to go. I would be engaging in some sort of process that aligns with your approach to quality area one. How do you do reflection? How do you do discussion questions? How do you do analysis of learning? Is there a format you can use there that you can just apply to the environment and to get everyone to take a step back and think carefully? And then, I'd be trying to do that, at least a few times a year, maybe each quarter or, every 6 weeks or something, where you can just take a step back. Not looking at judgment necessarily, but, think about how can we engage in that process. Having that as your quality improvement plan goal will mean that you can sort of have that ticked off as a process, a few times a year. All right, everyone, that's it for another episode. We'll be back. We won't be back next week. Sorry, I was about to say it's Easter next week and we'll be taking a little break from this extra series and we'll be back on the 30th of April. I really appreciate everyone listening. I know I've been missing a few episodes recently. It's been quite a busy time in work and with the podcast and everything else, which I know is me playing my violin and not of interest to the listeners necessarily, but we'll be back on the 30th of April, a break over Easter. I hope everyone gets a bit of time off and enjoys some of those extra days off. You're all doing incredible, amazing work in the sector, and it's fun doing this show, and it's great for some of the feedback I've been getting on the Facebook page. So the other thing I might say as well is, during that break is, use that time to either get in touch, earlyedgyshow@gmail.com or on the Facebook page, or you can comment directly on the Patreon website as well with feedback or let me know how you think it's going or if there are particular elements coming up that you're looking forward to. I'd love to hear from people. I hope they're enjoying the show. But that's it for this week, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Until then, it's goodbye from me.